Traumatic brain injury has been called the signature wound of the war in Iraq, but it's also a leading cause of death and disability of children and adolescents here at home. And yet it often goes undiagnosed and untreated. On today's Please Explain, Dr. Jamshid Gajar, a neurosurgeon and the president of the Brain Trauma Foundation, explains how head trauma can change a person's life. And Dr. Claudia Osborne, who sustained a traumatic brain injury during a bike accident in 1988, talks about treatment and recovery. And then a little later in the show, we'll also take your calls at 212-433-9692. And let's begin with you, Claudia. What's the official definition of traumatic brain injury?
Well, traumatic brain injury really is any time there is an injury to the brain. We don't tend to think of it as, you know, like a congenital defect or not necessarily a stroke. We usually do think of it in terms of the fact that you've had some kind of accident. You've fallen. You've been on a bicycle or a car accident are extremely common, and the brain usually gets a diffuse injury because as it is strikes something or something strikes it, there is a resounding force as that brain kind of shakes within the skull, and you tear connections throughout the brain.
Is a concussion a form of TBI?
Absolutely, absolutely, and very common form of traumatic brain injury, and one in which sometimes the person feels, no significant ill effects outside of a headache, if they're lucky.
So you don't have to lose consciousness?
No, you don't have to lose consciousness to have a TBI, but we tend not to, we have to be careful that we don't dismiss someone striking their head, waking up, and kind of moving on, because sometimes there's really more going on than meets the eye. For example, if a housewife falls down the stairs and no one's home, and she is knocked unconscious, but she doesn't know for how long, and she breaks her arm, she wakes up and she may really feel that nothing's wrong and everyone's focused on the broken arm, but when she tries to get back to her daily life, maybe a whole lot is wrong, but it goes a little unnoticed in her because she doesn't have a regular job, so she just kind of doesn't get back into her volunteer activities, and she stops making dinner for her husband and making his coffee in the morning and asking him how his day is, and her marriage starts falling apart. And, you know, so you can have that brain injury kind of missed in the process, which is what is happening, unfortunately, with many of our soldiers. They have massive injuries, and in the process, their brain gets quite a jolt. But if there's, you know, not an obvious wound, and by the time we've taken care of their major injuries, sometimes we've kept them intentionally unconscious on a ventilator for their major wounds. When they wake up, at first we're not expecting much of them in a hospital setting, and so we don't really notice that there's something wrong with their brain function until much later down the line when they're, you know, trying to get back involved in activities, and then people say, you know, Johnny's just not like he was before.
We're talking about traumatic brain injuries on today's Please Explain with Drs. Claudia Osborne and Jamshid Gajar. And this is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Jamshid, I was, the audience doesn't know about this, but last October I had a bike accident in Berlin, of all places. I wasn't wearing a helmet because nobody does. And wound up in the hospital with a big gash in my head. And the first thing they did was give me a CAT scan. Would that have given them an insight as to whether I had suffered from TBI?
Yeah, I mean, CAT scan is good to pick up neurosurgical lesions, I should say. So if you have, so a lot of times people fall down, hit their head, crack their skull, they have a skull fracture, or they may have a blood clot inside their skull, which can expand. And so if we just let you out of the emergency room after a head injury, that blood clot could expand, you go into coma, and you need emergent care. So a lot of times the CAT scan is the signature diagnostic test for somebody who has a head injury, comes in the emergency room.
So since nothing seems to have happened, I guess it didn't happen to me. But what can you explain what happens to the brain during closed head injuries as opposed to penetrating head injuries?
Right. So penetrating is usually something that penetrates the skull.
So that would we know that would be dangerous.
Yeah, a bullet, for instance, is penetrating. It comes from the outside, penetrates the skull. Or if you're in Iraq and a blast goes off, a lot of times they get shrapnel, it penetrates the skull. It's closed head injury where nothing really penetrates is the most common form, especially in civilian populations. So it's closed head injury. What happens is, and the part that really affects people is, as Claudia's explaining a little bit, is that it's the shear forces. So,
well, the brain hits the skull, doesn't it?
Right. Well, the brain turns inside, and so it's sort of turning on like a big piece of broccoli or something, like an artichoke. You sort of whip it around, and the brain is composed, if you think very simply, of brain cells on the top, and then these axons are connecting cables, and these connecting cables are the ones that can get sheared. And a lot of the problems people have, even in mild concussion, and those connections can get sheared, and you have problems with attention and memory, which are the main problems people have with mild or concussion head injuries.
Well, many football and hockey players endure multiple concussions. A recent article in the New York Times suggests that it's led to dementia in a number of notable cases, something that's like Alzheimer's.
Right.
So is there a link between Alzheimer's and TBI?
The leading cause of Alzheimer's disease is head injuries. So if you have multiple head injuries, you're much more predisposed to getting Alzheimer's.
Claudia, when this happens, does the brain swell?
Oh, often. You get an edema, a swelling of the brain, and that can be both initially or even a kind of a secondary effect of what really causes the trauma for the person. So they can have the initial trauma of what happens when their brain is struck, and then the secondary trauma to the brain caused by the swelling, which is why we have gotten so much better in developing our techniques for acute care.
Well, doesn't it also heat up sometimes?
I haven't heard that term before. but I think that you can get an inflammation, which probably you mean by heating up. So what happens is after an injury, what happens is there's swelling that causes the white blood cells to go in there, and an inflammatory process, which is sort of like almost a reaction to an infection. And the swelling can actually get worse on that basis.
Is it true that you should try to stay awake after a blow to the head?
Well, it's not staying awake. It's what's causing it. So a lot of times if a kid hits his head and her head and the parent, it's before bedtime, the parent's very worried because sometimes, especially a thing called an epidural hematoma, where you get a little crack on the side of the skull. The skull on the side is very thin, and you can get a crack there. It can cut a blood vessel and you get bleeding in the head. It can grow gradually over time. So in those cases, it'd be worthwhile to wake up the kid every couple of hours and make sure everything's okay. But actually physically staying awake, per se, it doesn't really make a difference.
I've always heard that the brain itself doesn't have feeling. Is that true?
Absolutely. We do a lot of neurosurgical operations in terms of mapping. So if you have a tumor that's very close to an area, say language or a motor part of the brain, can do awake operations, and you can touch the brain. There's no feelings. The covering of the brain has a feeling.
So what hurts when you receive a TBI? Is it the nerve endings in the skin on your head?
It's mainly the muscle fibers around in the scalp that cause the pain. Also, if you get some swelling, the covering of the brain, the dura or the meninges, they can get stretched, and you can get pain from that.
Claudia, does most of the damage from TBI occur at the time of the injury, or can the injury get worse?
Well, you know that at time of injury, but that, as I said, that secondary swelling, that sort of thing, is a big problem. But when people say things get worse over time, I think what they're referring to is people who aren't initially diagnosed sometimes and have frontal lobe changes, which are very common in a diffuse injury. So they have behavioral changes and things like that. If it's not initially diagnosed, then problems worsen in terms of their behavior not being identified and getting some help to work with it and change it. They can become a little more out of control that way. People who find that first their life kind of falls apart because they weren't diagnosed, and so people in their family don't understand, and so their marriage might end. Or of course they try and go back to work when they aren't yet able, and their boss, of course, is horrified by the fact that they're making so many mistakes and fires them. So it can worsen psychologically in terms of what those effects are for the individual until they get a little help to learn strategies and things like that. Because people who have a brain injury that has any significance in their life are not going to be readily aware of those deficits. You don't, it's like your computer being smashed. The computer then doesn't know what's wrong with itself. So you will see people with a brain injury, and initially they aren't aware that they have memory loss. They aren't aware that their right side doesn't function, or they're not aware of their speech changes.
I saw a report on ABC from Bob Woodruff, a man who knows something about this, in which he talked to a soldier and his wife, and the man who had had a great memory suddenly talked about how he couldn't remember anything. He was insomniac, he had an inability to focus and felt anxiety, mood swings, irritability, all connected with TBI?
Yeah. One thing that goes across the whole spectrum of traumatic brain injury, from concussion all the way to coma, from people that recover really don't recover, is attention and memory problems. So the main function of the brain that we all rely on is paying attention, because if you can't pay attention, you can't put things into memory. And it's a key part of brain function, and one that gets disrupted very easily.
Well, how soon, how crucial are the minutes, the hours, and the days following injury? Bob Woodruff, who was wounded in Iraq, as was that soldier he reported on, has described how part of his skull was removed to allow his brain to swell and cool off not long after his head wound.
Well, this is something that the Brain Trauma Foundation, we developed the national guidelines for severe head injury or severe traumatic brain injury. And so there's good scientific evidence that being aggressive early on in terms of alleviating brain swelling can produce better outcomes. So taking the skull off, monitoring the brain pressure, and also doing things very early on. The ambulance, obviously, giving oxygen and making sure the blood pressure is good are key points in terms of getting a good recovery.
Well, we've been hearing about so many soldiers not recovering or not even being diagnosed. How would the military know that somebody was suffering from TBI and required the kind of immediate attention that Bob Woodruff got?
So Bob Woodruff had a severe head injury. He was in coma.
So it was obvious.
So that's pretty obvious. But the part that's not obvious, the majority of head injuries, of traumatic brain injuries, are actually concussions. And those are ones with no physical evidence. The person maybe is in a car accident or exposed to an improvised explosive device in Iraq. And there's no shrapnel, no penetrating injury. They look okay, but their memory and attention are affected. And the problem is in the civilian population, about 20% of these patients with concussion go on to have persistent symptoms of attention and memory problems, and that's what needs to be diagnosed and treated.
Claudia, what happened with you after your accident? Were you treated right away?
Yes, no. I mean, I of course, was in the hospital, but
Were you wearing a helmet?
I was not wearing a helmet, as in my neighborhood bicycling and struck head-on, and should have been, of course, wearing my helmet, as I would if I was doing cross-country riding, but wasn't. And my understanding is that when I woke up, I demanded my release from the hospital, which was granted. I am a physician.
Well, you've been knocked unconscious, and so...
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's it's not an uncommon thing in the sense of a not being really aware of things being wrong. And and in my situation, I did probably worsen some over the next couple of weeks in the sense probably from some swelling, but that's because I was just kind of in a stupor state at home. And but, you know, I don't know that back then in 1988 we would have done anything really terribly different if I had stayed in the hospital.
So how did you get past this?
Well, I was very fortunate to get a lot of wonderful rehabilitation, which most people in the country do not get because that's not the way our healthcare system is set up. But I eventually, after 9 months after my injury, came to New York to Yehuda Ben Yishai's program at NYU's day treatment program for head injury, and I was there for about a year and a half. And in the process, one learns an awareness of the different deficits and problems one has, and one starts learning strategies to work around memory, attention, and more importantly, I think, things like what we would call executive functioning, that we lose our ability often to prioritize, to plan, to sequence.
So this is to some degree similar to what happens after someone has a stroke. You have to go through a rehabilitation process in which you relearn how to do things that you already knew how to do.
Correct. And often the whole time you're feeling like, well, boy, I know how to shower. But on the other hand, I haven't the clue what the first step is. And so someone has to move you through each of those steps to relearn dressing and showering. All the time you're pretty irritable because you're sure you know it, because as soon as they tell you, you know that. As a matter of fact, that was my prime phrase that I used for the first couple of years, was whatever someone said to me, I'd say, I know that. Because on some level I did, just not on the level at which I could do it, you know.
So we will take a little break and come back with more of this discussion and your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. My guests are Dr. Claudia Osborne, who sustained a traumatic brain injury during a bike accident in 1988, and Dr. Jamshid Gajar, a neurosurgeon, the president of the Brain Trauma Foundation. Stay with us. We're back with Please Explain. My guests are Dr. Jamshid Gajar and Dr. Claudia Osborne. We're talking about traumatic brain injury and taking your calls at 212-433-9692. And I hope that everyone who has the radio on who comes on the air will turn down your radio. Let's go to David from Long Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, how are you, Leonard? How are you doing there?
I'm well. And I'm sure the doctors are. They look great.
Oh, okay. And quick question. When my son was 5, we had him in a shopping cart standing up, you know? And he took a tumble out of it and crying, of course, you know, and I took him out of the store straight away, you know, and I calmed him down. But he had a big lump on his head, you know? And my wife and I, we made sure his eyes were all right and, you know, we wouldn't let him go to sleep or anything. Of course, we worried all night. But she wanted to take him to the hospital. I said, no, when I was a kid, I fell. He'll be all right, you know. But to this day, I often wonder if we did the right thing, you know. He's fine, very good student at school and everything, you know. But now and again, you know, like a kid, he just says, sometimes he sees things in the dark. And that's when I, like, get scared a little bit, you know.
What do you say, Jamshid?
Well, first of all, I'll give general medical advice, not specific.
You're not looking at the patient and the X-rays.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I think that if the lump on the skull is usually a little blood clot beneath the scalp. It doesn't necessarily mean there's something inside the skull. But I would have probably taken, and I wouldn't feel guilty about this because obviously your child sounds like he's normal now, but I would have probably taken the emergency room. You get a CAT scan, and then you can sleep easily.
But well, are our children more vulnerable? We got an email from a listener who says her 3.5-year-old foster child, soon to be her adopted son, was shaken when he was 3 months old by someone in his biological family and incurred an extremely severe brain injury that, and he was lucky to have survived. His injuries included bilateral subdural hematomas and retinal hemorrhages, and after 7 months in the hospital and a renowned rehab center for children, he was discharged to this foster family with medically fragile care training status. The child is totally blind, has cerebral palsy, a severe and uncontrolled epilepsy, and severe mental retardation.
Well, a lot of these the shaken baby syndromes are actually shaken baby impact syndromes. So basically, the baby gets shaken and then the head hits the floor or wall, and that's what causes these hemorrhages. And
but is that traumatic brain injury?
Yes. So any external force to the head is traumatic brain injury, as opposed to, say, a stroke, which is usually inside the brain, a blood clot, or infection or cancer. That's separate. So any external force applied to the head is traumatic brain injury.
But here's this baby who was born normally and now has all of these problems, including cerebral palsy.
Well, it's because it's severe damage while being shaken and, you know, probably had severe head injury in the process. So these are the outcomes, unfortunately.
Fred from Long Island, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. That's not really my name. I'm trying to remain anonymous, and I think you'll understand why when I share with you my situation. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I'm 57 years old, soon to be 58. I'm a physical abuse survivor. The abuse ended when I was 17 and a half years old by my father taking me in the backyard. And as we stood face to face, he began to hit the side of my head about 8 or 9 times. He didn't draw any blood. I remember him hitting my temples on both sides really hard. He was a big man, 6'2", about 220 pounds. And from that moment, October 66, until 3 months later when he signed me into the Army, January 67, it's a total black period. I can't remember anything. And to this day, I struggle with depression. A lot of anger. I don't know if it's related. I've often joked in a cynical way that maybe the guy gave me brain damage. I'm a recovering alcoholic, 12 years sober, recovering addict. But I have been finding in the last year I'm having trouble with my memory, all kinds of stuff. I don't know if it's related, but obviously the subject fascinated me, so I thought I would call and see.
Thank you for calling us and sharing that. Which one of you wants to talk to him? Claudia, you want to start?
I'd just like to say that it is, of course, not uncommon for people to have dual diagnoses, and it does make it more difficult to sort out. Certainly, alcohol and drug abuse can lead to marked problems with memory. Depression in and of itself mimics a lot of things in traumatic brain injury. You notice people with severe depression have trouble with concentration, attention, develops consequently some memory problems, things like that. So if you have somebody who also has a history of some trauma in their past, sometimes it is difficult to sort out. I think as one is older and one's got a history of all of those things going on, the important thing isn't what caused it. The important thing is instead to get one's life back on track in terms of working out systems and strategies that lead to the best quality of life one can create at that time.
So you write notes to yourself and do other things to help you get through the normal processes of life?
Yeah, I use an alarm, I use a digital recorder, I use a notebook system, and I use a computer. So, for example, just you think of simple things. If I go park my car, I record exactly where it's parked. And so I go right back to my car, whereas, you know, I see other people coming out of the mall and they're looking everywhere for theirs.
People who had no TBI.
That's right. So I use a system whereby if I set the recorder to remind me of something in a few minutes, I then also set the alarm if I set the alarm to do something several minutes later, I set the recorder to tell me why the alarm is going off. So I use that kind of system, and then I have, you know, detailed plans to help me get through the day, and then specific, what I call maps, that walk me through the steps of more complex tasks that I might do.
Now, Jamshid, a caller points out that meningitis can cause traumatic brain injury, at least the caller says so. She was comatose for 2 weeks at the Rusk Institute after contracting meningitis via West Nile.
Yeah, that's not considered trauma. So that's infections.
But it has similar results?
You can get similar results, but it's not traumatic brain injury.
Liz from Brooklyn, hi, you're on. Please explain.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a mild concussion about a year ago, and I lost my sense of smell. And I'm curious to know if you have any insights into how common that is and if there's any chance I might get it back and if there's anything I can do to get it back.
It's fairly common, traumatic brain injury. What happens is the frontal lobe slides over where the top of your nose is, and these little olfactory nerves are the nerves for smell that come there, and they're very... and they can be sheared off, so you can lose your sense of smell. Do you have problems with tasting?
Yes. I still taste, but not as well as I used to.
Yeah, so usually people lose smell, lose taste.
Well, smell and taste are linked together.
Yeah. And so usually it'd be good to go see an ENT specialist. And in general, people who don't recover, it's not for everybody, but generally if they don't recover after a year or two, the chances of coming back are slim.
These things have to be treated right away?
They're not treated. The nerves either grow back or they don't.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So it's just a matter of whether your nerves want to grow back.
Because
nerves do not grow back as easily as other cells.
Right. Some nerves grow back better than others.
Thank you so much, Liz. Richard from Yonkers. Hi, you're on. Please explain.
Yes. Hi. How are you? Nice to talk to you. I have just one quick question. I had a concussion about 1 year ago. Mild to moderate, I guess you'd call it. And I went for craniosacral therapy, which is an osteopathic treatment, and it did help me. I was having dizziness, loss of focus for about a week or so. I'm wondering if you have any information about whether that's valid or whether there's been any studies on such things for concussions.
I'll comment on that because I am an osteopathic physician. A lot of people, when they have some kind of trauma to the head or neck, have a lot of musculoskeletal changes, and so working with those frequently cause people to have a great deal of relief, especially from things like dizziness, nausea and vomiting, that sort of thing. So that can be often helpful. But and at the same time, just the active time going on after your concussion is probably playing a role as well.
Thank you so much for your call. A listener wants to know about prefrontal lobotomies, which they used to perform and now, I guess, are doing again. Is this a form? You look surprised. I've read recently they're doing them, and some people say they're much more precise, although it frightens me under any circumstances.
Right.
Is that a form of traumatic brain injury?
No, again, it's induced, I guess, with a knife. Or it could be called elective penetrating head injury. it's actually a very good book by Pressman called The Last Resort about the history of lobotomies, how it came about.
We had him on the show.
Yeah, it was a terrific book. But, again, this is something that's caused,
Vinny from Queens. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. My son suffered brain TBI some 8 years ago. He's on a lot of medications, but he's got hooked on marijuana. He says that keeps him calm. Is there a legal substitute for it? And is it common for TBI to get on substance abuse?
That's quite common for people with TBI to develop some substance abuse, and that is in part because when they notice behavioral changes, they can find that the use of a drug can, for example, make them feel calmer or make them feel more alive if they're very kind of adynamic and apathetic. It can make them more lively or engaged. It is a real huge mistake, of course, for people who have a brain injury to utilize alcohol or their own medications.
We're out of time, pretty much. If somebody suspects that he or she is suffering from TBI, where would you suggest they go, Jamshid?
Well, I think, first of all, immediately after having a head injury, you should go to the emergency room and get a scan, make sure there's nothing that's expanding or needs neurosurgical attention.
Thank you so much, both of you. On Monday's show, we continue our exploration of the brain with a look at how it can adapt and rewire itself. And then Judy Chicago talks about her art, and B. Arthur remembers bringing Maud to life. Plus, Dr. Jerome Groopman offers his insights on how physicians think about care and treatment. By the way, if you missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Tess Hartman, Jennifer Keeney-Sendro, and Bridget Bergen. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you on Monday.